Call the meeting to order, please. I'm only 2 minutes late here. Have roll call, please.
Commissioner Gilliland.
Here.
Vice Mayor Handy Peters.
Present.
Vice Mayor Matusik.
Here.
Mayor Masarzik.
Here.
Councilman Conroy.
Here.
Commissioner Curry.
Here.
Commissioner McGurk. Councilmember Saylor.
Here.
Mayor Kelly.
Here.
Councilmember DiLorenzo.
Here.
Councilmember Ford. Councilwoman Long.
Here.
Commissioner Revels.
Here.
Councilmember Patterson.
Here.
Councilmember Denny's.
Here.
Councilmember Cusack.
She is here.
County Chair Davis.
Here.
Councilmember Wagner. Mayor Emmett.
Here.
Vice Mayor Rogers. Councilmember Wheeler.
Here.
Commissioner Shoup.
Here.
Vice Mayor Burton. Mayor Gibson.
Here.
Mayor Sal. Councilmember Perone.
Here.
Linda Costello. Heather Blank. Judy Craig. Dustin Savage.
Here.
Jean Ferguson. And we have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Before we get started, I wish that everybody would take their cell phone and turn it off. If it goes off, that means the next project in your city or county will be half-funded by your city or county. If it's the state back there that their cell phone goes off, we will just have their head on a post out here.
So. Well, couldn't we make them pay for the whole project then?
No, they won't do that anyway. So we'll have the Pledge of Allegiance. Please stand. And before that, everybody knows that May 30th is Memorial Day, a day in remembrance of veterans who are not with us. And I'd like to ask just for a moment of silence before we have the Pledge of Allegiance. Thank you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I'll tell you what, somebody is out to get me in my chair. We have public participation. I have one comment card. Is anybody else here of public participation? Pardon me?
Big can't hear you.
I'm speaking into the microphone. First up, we have Mr. Ray Johnson from DeLand speaking on the roundabout at State Road 44.
Good morning.
You're recognized, Mr. Johnson.
Good morning. My name is Ray Johnson. I live at 1640 Alexander Drive in DeLand. My comments this morning concern the enhancement of the roundabout at State Road 44 and Grand Avenue. This roundabout poses a great opportunity, an opportunity to make a great first impression. It should be more than utilitarian. It should provide an aesthetic experience that is visually stunning, an entryway with beautiful landscaping, signage, and prestigious sculpture. First impressions generated by an aesthetic experience contribute to the economic development, and I know we're all interested in economic development. It contributes to the recruitment of new employers in addition to enhancing that visitor experience. When a community shows that it cares, and I use that word cares, about the image and the aesthetic experience and the quality of life, new employers take notice and will likely relocate here. Again, we have a great opportunity to make a good first impression and a lasting impression. Please enhance this roundabout. Public art defines a community. It is known that public spaces that include public art are more welcoming and more pleasing to residents and to visitors. Public art fosters meaningful connections between people and places. Please enhance this roundabout. It is essential to the health and wealth of this community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you very much for coming in this morning. Roman numeral 4, consent agenda, pulling item I off. Is there any other items to be pulled off the consent agenda?
Motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
We have a motion to approve the consent agenda items A through P, with the exception of item I. Is there any objection to the motion? Without objection, show the motion passes. Item I, the technical coordinating committee report. There was a motion passed at the meeting recommending that the River to Sea TPO send a letter of opposition to the relocation of the Richie Green rest stop from Seminole to Volusia County. I know that Volusia County has responded with the letter of opposition. I don't know if anybody else. Lee?
The city of DeLand has, and also the city of Orange City.
Okay. Well, this comes to us, their motion comes to us as a recommendation, which is a motion. There is no second, so we do have a motion on the floor to send a letter of opposition to the relocation of the Richie Green grass stop from Seminole to Volusia County. Is there any debate on the motion? Anybody opposed to the motion? Without objection, show the motion passes unanimously. Thank you. There will be a letter from us to do that.
In all caps?
Yes.
You can sit down and do that yourself.
All, caps.
All right.
Yeah.
Roman numeral 4, action item A, review and approval of River to Sea TPO board officers for fiscal year 2016-17. The nominating committee met on May 4th and drafted a slate of officers, and those being our TPO chairman, Commissioner Marshall Shoup from Flagler Beach, first vice chairperson, treasurer, council member Deb Dennis, Volusia County, second vice chairperson, secretary, council member Lita Handy Peters from DeBerry. Are there any other nominations for any of those seats?
Move to approve slate of officers.
Second.
Motion has been approved. Motion has been made to approve the slate of officers and seconded. Is there any debate? Any opposition? Without opposition, show the motion passes. Next item is item B, review and approval of the fiscal year 2016-17 River to Sea TPO budget. We took this up at the last meeting. So this comes in the form of a motion to approve the River to Sea TPO budget. And there is no second is required since it is a motion from the subcommittee. Is there any questions on the budget? I see Barbara back there. You have a...
No.
Oh, you gave me that look.
I was just watching you.
I'm used to that look from ladies, you know. I get it at home quite a bit, so I have to respond accordingly. All right, any debate on the budget? All right, is there any opposition to the budget, approval of the budget? Without objection, show the budget passes. Next item C, review and approval of resolution 2016 amending the planning PL funds joint participation agreement, JPA, to terminate on June 30th, 2016. Lois, do you want to take us on
yes,
that
thank
ride?
You, and good morning, everyone. We operate under a planning agreement with the Department of Transportation. Our existing agreement is going to be terminated by this action, and then the next item in your agenda will approve the new planning agreement to take effect. So this will take effect on June 30th, terminating the existing agreement, and then the new agreement will take effect immediately on July 1st, so there's no gap. We did present this before. There have been no changes or issues associated with it.
Is there any questions? I'll entertain a motion for approval.
So moved.
I have a motion for approval. Is there a second?
Second.
Motion for approval of the resolution 2016-16 amending the planning funds joint participation agreement to terminate on June 30th, 2016. Is there any debate on the motion? Without is there any objection to the motion? Without objection, so the motion passes. Item D, review and approval of resolution 2016-17 adopting the Metropolitan Planning Organizational Agreement taking effect on July 1st, 2016. Lois, you want to?
So again, this is the planning agreement that will replace our old JPA. The major changes of this particular agreement is that it'll now operate under a two-year term. So we'll be back in 2 years to renew. And it uses our Unified Planning Work Program, or UPWP, as a scope of services and attachment to the agreement. Makes it more a part of our contract. There's been a lot of webinars and meetings about this, and at the staff level, we're very comfortable with the way the direction that this is headed, and this is required in order for us to continue being funded.
Are there any questions of Mrs. Bollenbeck?
Move approval.
Second,
Matusik. I have a motion for approval and a second. Is there any debate? Is there any opposition to the motion? Without opposition, so the motion passes. Item E, review and approval of resolution 2016-18, amending the fiscal year 2015-16, 2019-20 Transportation Improvement Program, the TIP.
The Transportation Improvement Program, or TIP, includes all of our projects, and in this case, this particular amendment adds funding to three specific projects. One is the I-4 Managed Use Lanes project, as indicated in your agenda, and the other is to make up a shortfall, which we discussed at the last meeting, on the two segments of the East Central Regional Rail Trail project. That's, again, in two particular segments. And there is a handout at everybody's place or position regarding that particular project. The Department of Transportation had originally been seeking funds and were confident that they would be able to find some. And it turns out that they do not have funding in the current year. And this project is in a bit of a dilemma because the request for bids has already been out. And so the county now has received bids, and they have 120 days to execute a contract. And that deadline ends up coming in July. Of course, we don't meet in July. All of the bids came in higher than what has been programmed. And so we're looking for opportunities to close that shortfall. And in this particular case, again, in the current fiscal year, there are no funds. But as we know, we're very close to changing to the next fiscal year, at which point there will be potentially SunTrail money, as well as potentially other funds like the repurpose of earmark, which is something that we'll have to take up at this board. So right now, the county has agreed to go ahead and put local funds against this project so that they can continue to move forward and take advantage of the lowest bid that's being offered right now. Because I think everybody's pretty confident that if it had to be rebid, that the cost would go up quite a bit. And that's the direction of construction projects right now. So again, the handout right now shows local funds, but we do want to continue looking for opportunities to get that fully funded and alleviate some of the burden that's been placed on the county.
Commissioner Matusik, you have a question?
I guess more of a comment, too. It's part of the St. John's River to Sea Loop, and St. John's River to Sea Loop was first on the funding list, so I think we've got a pretty good opportunity to look at that for there. It's not going to go to the rest of the projects after the St. John's River to Sea Loop, so I think we can, you know, look at that and work with them to do that.
Sure. And a portion of that also makes up the coast to coast. So, again, we're hopeful that there'll be opportunities to.
Any other questions? We'll need a motion here.
I'd like to make a motion, Mr. Chairman, to approve.
Second and Tuesday.
Motion to approve Resolution 2016-18, amending the fiscal year 2015-16, 2019-20 Transportation Improvement Program, the TIP. Is there any debate? Is there any objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion passes. That takes care of all of our action items. We have some presentation status reports and discussion items. Presentation discussion on the roundabout at State Road 44 and Grand Avenue. It is, many of us know what had happened out there, and DOT and the county council's feelings and what we were moving toward. This is probably one of many future roundabouts defined in Volusia County. This probably won't be the only one. And there'll be a series, from what I understand, of public comments and meetings. So if you're inclined to support or hate roundabouts, you'll have every opportunity in the world. But we would like to have the presentation right now. Ms. Bolenbeck.
Thank you. Mr. Justin Vanson is here. He is a consultant working for the Department of Transportation on this particular roundabout, and he has some information to share with everybody.
Good morning, everybody.
He knows the rules. You are recognized.
FDOT asked me to present to you this morning. I was the engineer responsible for preparing the feasibility study that evaluated the roundabout and other control options about a year ago, and wanted to be able to kind of walk you through some of those findings and why the roundabout ultimately was selected to be advanced. So we'll quickly walk through some of the overview of the existing conditions, the comparison of the roundabout and signal, and the analysis that we had done, show you some of the current concepts. There has been some changes that the department has made to the concept that you saw in some previous meetings, and talk about the next steps. So as you may be familiar with, the existing intersection is undeveloped on three sides. This is located on the west side of DeLand. The northwest corner does have an existing gas station. The main line carries about 10,000 daily vehicles. Volumes out in this area are pretty consistent with volumes in the normal range for two-lane roadways. We're not dealing with overly high volumes or overly low volumes. They're pretty normal volumes for two-lane roadway. For the side street, there isn't necessarily an existing operational problem. While you get some some high delays day-to-day, overall, on average, you're seeing level of service C for most of the stop-controlled approaches and E on the northbound approach in the PM peak hour, and that's being graded on an A to F scale, kind of like you do with school report card. From a safety perspective, there was 30 crashes at the intersection between 2010 and mid-2015. I think of particular importance is the 18 injury crashes. So 63% of the crashes at the intersection were resulting in injury or fatality, which is a high number. And a lot of that's being due to the speeds of the approaches along State Road 44 through this area. The other key statistic is there's 73 angle crashes at this location. So nearly three-quarters of the crashes are these very severe angle crashes that are primarily occurring because people can't judge the appropriate gaps. They're coming up to the stop sign, they're stopping and looking for a chance to make their turn maneuver, and just with the high speeds, you're seeing those collisions where people are not accepting appropriate gaps. Unfortunately, that's resulted in two fatalities at this intersection, one in 2013 and then one that you're familiar with that happened most recently. Most of them are happening during daytime and during dry conditions, so this isn't something where we're seeing issues specifically with drainage or other types of issues at the intersection. We looked at a fair comparison between both the signal and the roundabout. We went into this without any preconceived notions of a traffic control solution. From an operational perspective, both the roundabout and the signal are expected to operate comparably. In the opening year with existing volumes today, if you looked at a signal, it would operate with LOSB. A roundabout would be slightly better from a delay perspective. But over the long term, they're actually pretty comparable. The signal would need additional southbound and northbound left turn lanes. And the roundabout, as a single lane that's being proposed, would allow for up to 5% a year growth over 20 years. So it provides significant spare capacity to allow for growth within this environment. The key difference is that the roundabout would reduce the speeds of the intersection, so you're going 25 miles an hour, where the signal would be allowing higher speeds through on the green. You still have that potential for some of the red light running. From a safety consideration standpoint, compared to the existing conditions, a signal is expected to reduce those severe injury crashes by about 40%, but they're only reducing total crashes by about 13%. So while you're addressing some of those severe angle crashes, there is an expectation that rear end crashes are going to increase, and the severity of the crashes is still going to be higher than what we'd see with the roundabout. The roundabout's expected to reduce the injury and fatality crashes by about 87% and total crashes by about 70%. And really this is due to fewer conflict points that reduce speed, is reducing reaction time for drivers. And the roundabout, from a safety perspective, is one of FHWA's 9 proven safety countermeasures. So this isn't something that we're still experimenting with. This is something that has been demonstrated in similar environments like this through several previous studies. Again, conflict points at the intersection are reduced with the roundabout, which is a benefit that's contributing to some of those safety performance that I was showing. At a traditional intersection, you have 32 vehicle conflict points, whereas those are reduced to 8 conflict points with a roundabout, basically one at the entry and one at the exit at each approach. The severity of those conflicts are also decreased. Where at a typical intersection, you're seeing the potential for these severe left turn and angle crashes, whereas with the roundabout, you have much more of a shallow merge type of a crash that generally results in a less severe conflict and a much lower potential for fatality. As we go through and look at monetizing those crash reductions and understanding what's the monetary societal impact of reducing the potential for those fatalities, reducing the potential for those injuries, the roundabout is coming up with a $8 million net safety benefit compared to the existing intersection. And that's over the life cycle, over a 20-year life cycle. Compared to the signal, you're seeing $4.4 million in additional benefit compared to what the signal would be providing. So in terms of cost, the costs are coming out where the slightly higher cost of the roundabout is going to be justified by the additional safety benefits providing. Some other considerations real quickly. The roundabout will be designed for all the expected vehicles that are going through it, so tractor-trailer traffic, buses, vehicles pulling boats, emergency vehicles. So that's all part of the consideration in the design. The roundabout has been modified, and I'll show you in the next slide what the current concept is looking like, but it's been modified to stay within the right-of-way. So there is not a right-of-way consideration difference between the signal or the roundabout option. And both the roundabout and the signal option were maintaining access to that existing gas station. Previous concept that you may have seen did have adjustments to the driveway on State Road 44. This is the current concept that DOT has been working with that added the left turn lane into the gas station back into the design. So maintaining both the accesses that are out there currently today. Again, the width of the roundabout has been shrunk a little bit from the previous concept that you saw. It was shrunk down from about 160-foot diameter to 140 in the narrow direction. This concept was actually widened out a little bit to be more of an oval shape, so it's 175 feet long by 140 feet wide. And these dimensions are, the 140-foot dimension is pretty typical for a rural single-lane roundabout. This is a transitioning area coming from a rural into the urbanized area. So for the truck traffic that we'd expect and for the speeds, it's a pretty typical size. Again, roundabouts in the U.S. are not new. They're new in Volusia County. They're still something that's evolving within Florida, especially within FDOT. But Florida is a state that's leading the nation in terms of the number of roundabouts that are on the ground in certain areas, like Sarasota County has a lot of them. The villages have a lot of roundabouts. But every state in the nation now has roundabouts, and we've got over 25 years' experience in the U.S. Another key consideration is the speed environment. I think that's been a concern for folks. Roundabouts have been proven to be successful within these higher speed environments and being able to reduce those vehicle speeds down to that slower speed environment going into the roundabout. This is an example from Kansas where this approach coming into the roundabouts, you're seeing this photo, is a 65-mile-an-hour posted speed that's transitioned down through longer splitter islands and through signing. This has been in the ground for over 10 years and has an excellent safety performance. It also carries about 50% truck traffic. This location is a new roundabout south of, I think it's in Lake Wales. It's in the middle of an orange grove. It's SR-17 at Hunt Brothers. It's been built by District 1 with about 6 months ago. It's had no crashes. It carries a large amount of loaded citrus through it in tractor trailers. So This one's actually a little bit smaller than the one that we're proposing. Gateway treatments were brought up by another gentleman this morning. The roundabout does provide an opportunity as a gateway coming into the city of DeLand. These are a couple of examples of other municipalities that have put signage and landscaping to be able to enhance their gateway coming in. There's other examples I could show you where they're much fancier with large statues, etc. So the sky's the limit with what you can do within the Central Island. One more quick example that I wanted to show you. This is another one in Lake County that was recently built. It was built about a year ago. Note that you've got several different types of vehicles all traveling within the roundabout at the same time. Again, the slower speeds bringing the vehicles down to about 25 miles an hour. Everybody's able to easily navigate together. This one in Lake County, from 2002 to 2012, had 32 crashes and 2 fatalities. Those are probably pretty familiar statistics to what I showed you at the beginning of the presentation for this 44 Grand intersection. Since the roundabout opened in 2015, in June 2015, so almost a year ago, there's been no crashes at this location. So, again, some similar statistics from local environments in Florida, and this is something that if you were concerned about the roundabout here at 44 and Grand, I'd encourage you to go take a look at this one in person. This one's a little bit larger than the one that's being proposed. It was about 175-foot diameter, but again, pretty comparable. Before I get to the next steps, I was going to show you a quick video. This is the roundabout that I was just describing to you in Lake County. It's about a 40-second clip. Shows a couple of different vehicles there. You got tractor trailer traffic. And notice that the size of this one, again, is a little bit bigger, but the trucks going through it don't even need to use the truck apron on this one. The other thing to note is that because the slower vehicle speeds, you have bicyclists going through pretty easily. The speeds of the vehicles entering and circulating are all fairly similar to the speeds of the vehicle, that the bicyclists will be traveling. So all those streams are able to interact much easier than if a bicyclist was trying to make a turn maneuver through a standard intersection. In terms of next steps, the design build for the roundabout has already been advertised by DOT. $1.35 million was budgeted for the project. It's expected to have notice proceed in June of this year with a 250 calendar day schedule for construction. So some things are moving quickly with this location. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Do we have any questions? Yeah. Ms. Denny's?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question in transitioning. I don't remember, we talked about this at the executive committee in here. Will there be signage before you get to the roundabout? Because all of a sudden we're going to be changing a traffic pattern there. Will there be a way to alert the motorists before they get there?
Absolutely. Yeah, typically what you'll see is you'll see a larger, we call it diagrammatic sign, the much larger signs that indicate the roundabout and provide destination information, and then you'll see the roundabout ahead sign, as well as additional road name signage. Those are all provided in advance of the distance that's needed for drivers to be able to react to the intersection and begin to decelerate. So that's all being considered as part of the design.
Commissioner Matusik?
I have a couple things. Thank you for the presentation. The city of DeLand, even though it's not in the city limits is just past there. And again, I want to thank Ray Johnson for being here. I know he's made a presentation to the county as well. And aesthetics are certainly important coming into the city of DeLand, so we'd like to have some discussion on that as well. The city commission also asked me if I could ask DOT to come and do a presentation to our city commission, so they can understand exactly how it is. Even though it's not in the city, some of the commissioners and the mayor have gotten some questions, and some residents are in opposition to it, so they would like a presentation from DOT. So if somebody could call our city manager, Michael Plois, and set that up for one of our commission meetings. Also, bicycles certainly are an issue at that intersection. That is a trail connection for the spring to spring trail on each side. So I'd want to make sure. I'm not sure when that segment of trail is looking to be done or actually what the design is going to be on which side, so there'll need to be some consideration in the beginning sooner than later. We know it's coming through there, and maybe that conversation, even though we might not be able to build it, at least have that conversation, because I'd hate to put $1 million in and then we have an issue knowing that trail is going to come through. So that's an important aspect.
That
as
was
well.
A consideration as part of the original concept, and they've retained it in this modified design where you do have splitter islands to be able to have pedestrians crossing in two stages. So yes, that'll be part of the considerations.
And also, there's been talk about four-laning 44, and I'm not sure where that is. I know we're building a new bridge over the river. There, right now, it'll be two-lane, but it's being built and designed to add another two lanes on there for that four-laning. And I think that that's important, because if we end up four-laning 44 within the lifespan of this roundabout, there's going to be a huge cost to either retrofit it to do the two-lane or the four-laning there of 44, or just do another roundabout. So I was a little concerned, and that was one of the comments from the commission as well. I don't know what DOT's timeline at looking at I-44. I don't know what the numbers are to make that, but if it's within 10 years that we're going to four lane 44, this roundabout's going to be out of date, which is certainly in the early part of its lifespan. So, yeah,
and we had looked at that as part of the feasibility study as well, and looked at setting up the roundabout for staging, so there's opportunities to do that. The numbers that we were looking at was showing that it probably would not be within the 10-year horizon, that the intersections and that the roadway segments would be at a position where you'd need the widening. So you're probably looking at beyond a 10-year horizon, in which case setting it up for the initial single lane I think is reasonable. As I mentioned before, the roundabout itself, the intersection, which is where the capacity constraint would be, would accommodate up to 5% a year growth before it would reach capacity on any of the approaches. So you've got quite a bit of lifespan there. Kind of the big X factor becomes what happens with some of the development in the vicinity, and if you have the SunRail come in and with timing of some of that is. So that'll impact the growth, but in terms of growth rate, you can get pretty substantial growth through that intersection without need for improvement.
But those were just some concerns from the City of DeLand and our City Commission, so thank you.
Okay, Chair Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson.
You have a question?
Well, kind of a comment or two. Number one, has the question is, the family of the most recent incident has contacted me, and they've come to the council. Have they contacted the DOT to be the ones to, I guess, adopt the internal median area? We don't know yet?
I think that's something that we'll have to forward
over. They're not aware.
Yeah, that'll have to be something. Y'all are going to have some more discussions about this, correct?
In terms of the landscape?
Public participation.
Yes, there's there's a series of public meetings and additional public involvement activities that will be upcoming.
So that'll be taken into consideration.
All right. Also, one other, I've been, ever since we came up with the idea of the roundabout here, I've been contacted by a lot of people that drive up and down this road, not just cars, but the semi-truck drivers. My brother knows a lot of them. They call me. We've got a lot of log trucks that go up and down this road, which are a little longer, different, weirder wheelbase and all that stuff. And I will be happy to report back to these people that, we're making this thing wide enough so these things don't have to swing wide on these turns, because that can be a further problem. According to what we just saw, that's what's happening. So I will.
There's a lot of locations within the Midwest, particularly where they're getting into locations where they have wind farms, where you're bringing through oversized, overweight loads through these roundabouts even. So they can be set up for some very large vehicle types. If you're getting into some of those oversized, overweight categories, there's some additional considerations. But, yes, these will be set up for all of the expected vehicles that are going to be going through.
Yeah, because we're starting back our construction boom again, and there's going to be some very long, heavy equipment being moved up and down that road again.
Yep.
So I appreciate that. I will report back to them and let them know. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Since the question came up about widening these in the future to two lanes in each direction, have you done studies to show all of the statistics regarding safety and movability with regard to the two-lane roundabouts? I'm from New Jersey, and you know they had, we called them circles in the old days, and the big joke with them, I think they removed most of them, if not all of them, but the big joke was if you ever got in that inside circle, you're there forever.
You'll probably hear a lot of people in meetings where we're talking about roundabouts try to make the differentiation between a traffic circle and a roundabout or a rotary. The term traffic circle can refer to a lot of different things. Some circles had stop control on them. Some were set up where you had to change lanes within the circle. So I think the key distinguishing factor we're talking about with roundabouts here is you're going to have yield control on the entries, so everybody that's coming in always has a yield, not a stop sign, not a signal. And the other distinguishing factor is you get into the appropriate lane on the approach, and that lane carries you all the way through the roundabout to your intended exit. You don't have to change lanes within the roundabout, so you don't get into the situation where you're getting trapped. Actually, if there's an expectation that you need to change lanes within the roundabout, the roundabout hasn't been designed properly. If people feel the need that they should be changing lanes. So I think a lot of those issues have been addressed with the current roundabouts. Now, there's always bad apples out there. There's examples where multi-lane roundabouts aren't performing as well as they could. But on the whole, the studies are continuing to show that even multi-lane roundabouts are performing better than the comparable signals, particularly when you're getting into the severe injury and crash reductions.
So you have done those studies.
Yeah, so they've been doing studies about every 5 years. So the most recent study happened in 2013, and then there was a prior study in 2003, so I guess 10 years. They've been going through and collecting nationwide crash data at a variety of different locations and continuously comparing. And individual states have been doing more regular updates to their safety statistics as well.
Mayor Kelly, you have a question?
Just a quick observation. I spent a lot of time, three and a half years in Europe, and roundabouts there were as many as six lanes around the Arc de Triomphe, and that was the one where if you did get on the inside and were to exit, you might be in trouble. But when Councilperson Matusik brought up the point, if you four-laned it, two lanes coming in, would you still only have one entry point?
So,
and have it narrowed down where those two lanes merge? Because in England, you'll have as many as three, and you come in, if you're going to exit to the right at the first exit or the second one, you will move to the right, which people know that. My question is, if you widen it, this intersection, interchange, is too small to add the additional lanes to come in and out.
So with the size of the round, so the width of this direction is pretty consistent with the multi-lane roundabout. So typical outside diameter is about 175 feet. The width that's been reduced this direction is smaller than we'd probably need. But that was needed to be able to fit it within the right-of-way and to be able to get the project advanced in a tighter timeline.
I think this is where you have to have advance notice that if a person wants to exit the first, say they want to go north, if they're coming from the west or the east and they want to turn right, they need to be in the right-hand lane.
Correct.
Instead of the second lane. It's going to take, and maybe that would be marked with lanes.
Yeah, to your point about the lanes, yes, you'd have a partial two-lane roundabout. So basically the main line would have two entering, circulating, and exiting lanes, and it'd be better if I had a figure to demonstrate it. But you basically, if you can envision adding an additional lane to the east-west entry within the circles for roadway and to the mainline exits in both directions. The side streets would stay single lane entries and exits, and these portions of the circulatory roadway would remain single lane. And on the approach, if you were turning left, you'd be in the left lane. If you're turning right lane, you know, the same as you would have for anything else.
And others in here have indicated they've traveled and used circles or interchanges. I think this is a perfect place to put one. The last time I was sitting here, we were discussing roundabouts on ISB in certain locations, and having the long distance that you have between the next entry point makes this ideal from a safety, in my opinion. I'm not an engineer, but it just makes sense that you're going to be slowing down, you're going to be entering. You only have to look one way whether you're going in or out. You don't have to worry about traffic if you're going east you don't have to worry anything about somebody coming from the left. Nobody's coming from the right unless they go the wrong way, which hopefully that may not.
There's been a pretty strong trend over the last 10 years among states across the U.S. for roundabouts in this type of location, specifically for improving safety. You know, the urban environments also work well, but in particular, when you're starting to look at signals in a higher speed environment or two-way stop in a higher speed environment, the roundabouts, you know, getting those speeds down has been a key benefit, and the safety performance has been really, really stellar. And so using this to transition from that higher speed environment into DeLand, into that lower speed environment, I think also provides a really nice gateway, really nice benefit.
Okay, I believe Ms. Craig?
Yes.
And then Ms. Petusik, and we'll wrap this up.
Real quick. I live 2 miles away, as you know. I've been to the villages, and every mile there's a roundabout, and it does slow the traffic down. But what I did notice was if you're not real comfortable with the area, if you don't have a forewarning before you hit that roundabout, you could go right and get out of the round traffic that you want to do. So what type of signage are you going to have out, or what are you going to do about forewarning people that aren't up with that's there?
Yeah, so the nice part about this design is, at least for the first at least 10 years of operation, if not longer, is it's going to be operating as a single lane, so you don't have to worry about getting into issues with which lane you need to be in as you're approaching it. The only decision that will have to be made is the drivers to recognize that there's an intersection there and start to decelerate and be able to slow down. And what you're going to have, whether you have a signal there or a roundabout there, is just that deceleration. Once you get up to the yield line, there's one lane in, one lane out, and so it's pretty simple from a navigation standpoint. When you get into the additional situation, like you're talking about in the villages, where most of those are multi-lane roundabouts, yes, there's additional signing and additional pavement marking arrows to provide guidance to drivers on which lane to get into. But that's the nice part is the drivers here will have a long break-in period before you ever get into that conversation where they'd have to, you know, they'd get used to the roundabout before the additional complexity of the multi-lane configuration.
So what you're saying is you're going to put the roundabout in, but you're not going to put any kind of signage either way to alert the driver that it is coming up.
No, there definitely is signage.
Okay.
There's going to be signage on the approaches, both to warn drivers that it's coming. There'll be roundabout head signage as well as guide signage to show drivers' destination information. So they're definitely signing to warn the drivers. My point is that you're not getting that additional complexity of the multi-lane where you don't have to worry about getting them into a correct lane.
Right. I've read a lot of studies, and there are specifically out in California where they put a lot of them in. They're taking them out now, and I'm sure you're aware of.
That's actually incorrect. There's only been one or two that I'm aware of that have been taken out in California, and one of them was actually there was a lot of public backlash to it, so they put it in as a temporary roundabout, and basically they just poured some asphalt curbs, and it was really ugly, and it was not the full size. They basically put in something smaller that fit within the right-of-way as a demonstration, and the public hated it, and so it got pulled out. But it was as much about the poor geometry and how they sort of wedged it in as a temporary roundabout as it was the roundabout itself. The other one, I'm not sure of the circumstances, but it's not a trend. The trend from Caltrans and from the local agencies is they're putting in roundabouts at a pretty high rate.
Now, the starting of the project will be next year, June of 17.
Nope. This year.
This year.
Yes.
Okay. What's going to happen with the traffic while that construction's going on?
So maintenance of traffic is something that will be worked through as part of the design process. I'm not aware of what the current plan is, but my expectation is that they would be maintaining traffic along 44 through construction.
Okay. Thank you.
And there is the current signal out there today.
Commissioner Matusik?
Back to the bikes, and I had forgot that when I was talking about the bikes. I pulled the FHA technical summary on roundabouts and bicycles and addressing that. Yeah. But are you going to do a slip lane for the bicycles to come off so that if they don't feel comfortable, they don't have to stop and get off as a pedestrian? Because, as I said, that that's huge through there. So if you put a slip lane to connect to the crossover there for the pedestrians to get them on the trail or sidewalk, which is going to have to be wider than a normal sidewalk to accommodate the bicycles, and then to come off, I think it might be a little easier transition, especially when they get up there, they may get concerned because of the truck, and then there's no way for them to bail. So they could do a slip lane before they get to the pedestrian crossing, end up into the pedestrian crossing to take the trail or the pedestrian way around and then back out.
Yeah, and that's exactly what's being shown here. It's a little hard to see, but these little red dots are the ends of the ramps. So the bike lanes, so the shoulder actually gets dropped in advance of the roundabout, and so the bicyclists would either be given the opportunity to merge in with traffic and claim the lane, or to exit the roadway here onto the adjacent multi-use path and travel around. And I expect that there's probably going to be a little bit of refinement to this as it goes through the design process, maybe to smooth out that corner a little bit, things like that. But yes, the intent is to give them the option to go and exit the roadway for anybody that's uncomfortable. For the speed environment that this roadway is, I would expect that the majority of cyclists that are using this facility are going to be the more experienced type that are probably going to be less inclined to leave the road, but it is being provided. With the new trail crossing, that will bring less experienced riders to the area as well, and so that is a consideration.
Are you going to do a slip lane on the Grand side as well?
So the...
Because that's where the bicycles come
from. So these bicycle ramps are being provided on all of the approaches.
Okay.
Well, actually, excuse me, on the main line. This concept is not showing the bike ramps on the side street, but those certainly could be another consideration. The bicyclists, as currently laid out here, looks like if they wanted to exit, would use the pedestrian ramp.
Yeah, so. And the bikes are more obviously on Grand, going from one side of Grand to the other side of Grand across 44. So if we could make sure we could put slip lanes on Grand as well, because they'll get up to Grand, up to 44 on the Grand side,
sure.
And then they don't have any place to bail. So if we could look at putting slip lanes on all approaches.
We'll make notes of that for the design build team.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. If you could stay around after the meeting, maybe there's a few more questions that'll pop up and they'll come and talk to you. I will comment that you're probably the only one of the few engineers I've ever heard get up and speak that I could actually understand. My father-in-law was a chemical engineer, and I could never understand what he was trying to tell me. He always had a lot of questions, but he never really wanted to take my advice. So it was quite interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One thing I've learned a lot about as it comes up with the roundabouts, the biggest objection I hear from a lot of people is, we've never done it that way before. So, you know, I'm glad that you're going to be doing a lot of, especially the information there on crashes. That's the most critical element there. That saving people's lives and reducing the amount of damage that, as an insurance agent, it's something I'm very cognitive to. So thank you very much for being here. Next up, presentation and discussion of the draft 2016-17 to 2020-21 Transportation Improvement Program, the TIP.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson. I'll keep my comments brief. The Transportation Improvement Program, of course, is our five-year program of projects. And each year, as we move forward, we update the TIP to remove the fiscal year that's coming to an end and to begin to add that out year and projects that are there. And so a part of what we do is we develop a comparison report so that rather than looking through the entire TIP document and having to figure out what's changed, you can just look at the projects that actually have been changed. At that, it's still 182 pages, so my apologies. That particular comparison report, a good number of the projects that are included in it are projects that have been completed during the year and that old year dropping off. So you see them going basically to zero and being removed from the program. But there are some projects that I just wanted to highlight. Obviously, the Grand Avenue Roundabout is one of them. The Holzenbach Drive sidewalk, which came from our set-aside. There's been a series of Volusia County projects that have been added, including a Beresford extension, a widening of Howland, which is also a long-range plan project, Orange Camp Road, Park Avenue, in Edgewater. The replacement of the St. John's River Bridge on State Road 44 that was referenced during Justin's presentation. Again, that's still in its early stages. Old Kings Road extension up in the Flagler Palm Coast area, which is also a long-range plan project. And then there's some additional right-of-way funding, both for the widening on Clyde Morris and the widening on US 92. With that being said, I'm happy to entertain any questions that you might have. This is just here for your review this time around. Next month, this item will be back so that we can actually adopt the new TIP.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Lois. Lost my place here. Next item to be, let me see. Okay. Presentation discussion of the draft priority project list.
Thank you. Each year, the River to Sea TPO and all the MPOs around the state develop a series of transportation priority lists. And we send these lists to the Department of Transportation for their use in building the work program. And that's how projects move generally from our long-range plan into the five-year TIP. Projects are either specifically identified in the long-range plan if they're capacity projects, or the programs, such as our set-aside programs, are identified in the long-range plan. And that's where these projects are derived. So we go through this process usually in the fall of each calendar year. We bring all of the policy issues to the board, and we set up different resolutions to guide the process. And then we use a subcommittee of volunteers from our bicycle committee, our technical committee, our citizens committee, to review and rank and come up with draft project lists. And those lists are included in your agenda packet. So, as happens each year, we end up with some projects that just don't fit the history of these programs. And so the committees waded through a number of those, and the executive committee at their last meeting also dealt with some policy issues. A new project that was requested for funding was ITS management, so not the actual installation of the infrastructure, but the O&M that is associated with systems once they're put in place. And we deferred to move forward with that project this year. There was a request for an emergency signal that had already had a signal warrant study done by DOT, and the DOT doesn't support it. So we declined to rank a project that we know the department does not support. That will be included and was recommended to be included as a part of another study to look at the improvements that they're trying to accomplish. There was also a request for a roadway extension project, which technically is a capacity project. So that project would have had to have been listed in the long-range plan, and it's not. So those are some projects we've notified the applicants and their respective board members that we weren't able to rank those. But there are two items that still sort of remain open. One has to do with the interchanges along I-95. And we were thinking that that was going to enter into our planning studies as a part of this project as a request from the subcommittees, and that didn't happen. We identified in our long-range plan three interchanges that need improvements or that are identified for improvements. One is an interchange at Pioneer Trail, and we know that the department is already doing an interchange justification report there. The other is an interchange at LPGA Boulevard because of all of the development that's slated to occur. And then also at US 1, which is a very old interchange that has a lot of safety and operational issues associated. So I'd like for this group to consider that we go ahead and add those three interchanges to our planning studies list that we submit to DOT so that they can continue to study and know that the MPO supports the DOT allocating study money for those interchanges.
Mr. Chair, I make a motion. We add the three interchanges to the report.
I have a motion. Well, you were right there, Mayor Kelly.
Pardon? Sorry.
It must be, you have a vested interest in that.
That's a vested interest for the community because it's the first exit to Volusia County, to Daytona Beach, to Holly Hill, to South Daytona. And if you Google Ocean Center, that's the exit you take. And it's the most poorly designed, it is the most poorly designed interchange, I think, in Florida. And one of the worst on 95. There are only a few that I've traveled on 75 and 95 that are any worse. So I guess I've used up my time. Sorry.
We have a motion to add those three projects, the I-95 North, the LPGA, and that
Pioneer Trail.
And, yeah, Pioneer Trail. Is there any debate? There's a second on the motion. Is there any objection to the motion of adding those projects to the... Without objection, so the motion passes. All right.
The other item that remains somewhat unresolved is an application that had come from the city of South Daytona on a quiet zone, establishing a quiet zone within their city. And this is upgrades that would be required at various railroad crossings. And once you upgrade those safety requirements, the trains don't have to toot their horn quite as often, which is sometimes very important for folks that live closer to those railroad tracks. And there had been, I think, some question about whether or not that project was coordinated with the local district rail office representative, and we have had some conversations with that individual where initially they said no, but it turned out they had been contacted and were not able to attend some of the coordination meetings that were being set. And this is important to the city of South Daytona also because they've already received a grant award at the state level from the Department of Transportation to help pay for this project. And so those are state funds, and by being on our set-aside list, it provides an opportunity, obviously depending on where it is in the process and monies that are available, but it does provide them with an opportunity to potentially take advantage of federal funds that might be available to match those state funds. And so the committee had originally declined ranking that project because it didn't have local coordination, which is typically something that we look for. As I mentioned with the signal project earlier, if the DOT doesn't support something locally, us requesting money doesn't make it any better. But in this particular case, the DOT at the state level has already awarded a grant for this project. And so I would ask for the board to also agree to add that project. And if you want to hear any more from South Daytona, they stand ready to make their appeal.
Ms. Long, would you like to make a motion?
Yes, I make a motion that this be added to the list.
What be added?
The South Daytona Quiet Zone project.
Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any debate? I understand if there's anybody here that is opposed to it. I hear that the city manager, Mr. Yarbrough, is willing to take you out on a deep sea fishing trip to discuss the issue with you. Is there any objection to the motion to add the no toot zone or the quiet zone? Without objection, so the motion passes. Is that it?
No, I just want to also bring to your attention that as a part of this process, of course, we always, as a subset of our projects that are considered regional in nature, they move forward to the Central Florida MPO Alliance regional list that gets submitted, and those are the strategic intermodal system projects. They are the transit, the regional transit projects. In this case, that would be SunRail or the SunRail Extension study, those sorts of things. And then also regional trails, which, as we all know, the St. John's River to Sea Loop and Coast to Coast are a part of that particular system. And so they go on those projects. And how we handle that is we use our priority lists and the same order of projects, and anything that fits the regional definition we place on the Central Florida MPO Alliance list. There is also a desire by the Alliance at this point to go ahead and update the TRIP list, which is the Transportation Regional Incentive Program. And this is a 50-50 matching program for regionally significant projects. And it requires MPOs to get into an interlocal agreement to go ahead and identify those projects. The last interlocal agreement was executed in the last TRIP list, I think, in 2005. It's very, very old. It certainly doesn't represent our current long-range plan. And the Alliance is looking to go ahead and renew the resolution that approves those TRIP lists. And the process for doing that is that we submit as an MPO our list of projects that are eligible, and the agreements just approve those projects. They do not rank them, and they do not remove any projects that we have on the list. And so at your station, there is a draft listing, and we'll bring that back hopefully for your approval next month so that we can have that agended and voted on by the Central Florida Alliance reps at the July meeting that's scheduled for the Alliance. That is all I have. Again, this item, I'm happy to answer any questions, and certainly between this month and next month, if you have any specific questions about the ranking or the projects that are included on these lists, please don't hesitate to call us and sit down with us to review them, and we'll bring this back for approval next month.
Commissioner Gillen?
Yeah. Lois, could you, the items that are in red, I'm looking at the right list, correct? So they weren't included on a 10-year-old list of regional significance?
The TRIP sheet that you're talking about, there's state law, and then there's some guidance that DOT has put out, and basically it says that these projects have to be of regional significance, they have to be in your long-range plan. So there is the broad set of roadway segments that are of regional significance, and then there is the subset of those projects which are included in our long-range plan and can move forward and be eligible for TRIP money. Now, that doesn't have to be in the cost-feasible portion of our long-range plan. It could also be in the needs list, because TRIP money is not a factor in the funding of our long-range plan. It's separate and aside from.
And specifically, what I'm looking at is the Timber Creek extension to from LPGA up in Norman. And that is in the long-range plan as Stagecoach, I believe, is the name of the road. But yet on this, it's identified as not being regionally significant. It's on the first page, fifth from the bottom.
Anything that's on this list is identified as being regionally significant. This is the list that we are proposing to use.
Okay, so they'll be included, but the ones in red are actually...
They've just been, I think, added since the original list. So they're not included on that old original list.
In 06.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, that had been originally adopted a decade ago.
So when we submit the list as the final, they won't be in red.
They'll correct.
Be, okay, I understand.
Correct.
So this was just for, okay,
yes.
I got you.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Lois. Next item, presentation and discussion of the draft transportation impact analysis, the TIA methodology update. Lois, or?
So I've talked about this before. The transportation impact analysis is a set of guidelines that had been put in place originally back in 2007. And the idea is when there is new development being permitted, a transportation impact analysis typically has to be performed. And this MPO worked with local governments as well as the development sector, private development sector, to come up with some standards for performing those studies. The methodology is written with a good deal of flexibility, but it does create at least a framework or format with which to start that discussion. And so we have Bob Wallace with Tyndall Oliver, and he's been working on this for quite some time, and he's here to present to you.
Okay. Mr. Wallace, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. Pleasure to be for you today. You have the agenda item, Lois's quick overview, and also the presentation. So I thought, rather than go through it, I would give you a couple of things that I think are important, and then see if you have any questions, and then update at the end, so we'll keep it short. So as Lois pointed out, we basically, the last time this was looked at was 2009, and since that time, there's been a lot of changes. The changes, basically most noteworthy, I think, is the fact that the metropolitan planning area boundary has been expanded further into Flagler County. And now that necessitated expanding the TIA process to also include Flagler County. Also, there's been a lot of discussion about this is a capital investment analysis. It is not dealing with operating costs. It's capital right now. And one of the changes that was made in this process is to look at multimodal improvements, transit, bicycle, and pedestrian improvements. And so we've modified some of the sections in the process to basically address and allow the flexibility to address transit, for example, and bicycle pedestrian improvements. So there's a lot of technical minor changes that have occurred. And we have, let me just run to the summary slide real quick. We've presented to FCARD, BCARD. We have had workshops with them. We've got good input from both of them, from the local governments that also attended those meetings. And we recently just went through the Technical Coordinating Committee and Citizens Advisory Committee. We got input from both of them. And what we did at that Technical Coordinating Committee is say, let's have one last shot at any changes or comments that you guys might have. Get it to us by June 3rd, and then we will make any pass at the final document changes to bring back to the committees and to the board in June. And that will establish the process and hopefully approve the process that then, as you probably, many of you probably remember, was also then adopted by resolution of the local governments and or references to this standardized process in their comprehensive plan or land development regulations. So what we would like to see happen is the board approve it in June and have a couple of months for the local governments to come back and demonstrate their acceptance either through resolution or changes to their technical standards land development code that references the TIA. Some communities may not have to do anything. Some might have to do something. So that's a big picture overview of where we've been and where we're heading for in the next month or two. With that, Mr. Chair, if anyone has any questions, I'll certainly be glad to try to answer them.
Any questions? At my age, when you mention TIA, you're almost talking about a stroke. You know?
Traffic impact analysis.
Yeah.
It's not so much on this TIA, but I know you did a presentation to us on the 17 corridor, and it's being taken up by our commission Monday night to look at and review that Highway 17 segment. That timeline of June the 3rd was the same for that. Obviously, we're not going to be able to get it done till that June meeting, till after that. Was that timeline changed for that 17 corridor while I have you?
Yes.
Yes, yes it was.
So what is the timeline? Because I know Orange City's interested in that as well, while we got you there.
I think what we were trying to do is make sure we got comments soon enough to get any impact of the comments in the final report that will be sent out. So if we have a little flexibility in that, then I think if you needed another week or something like that, Lois, what do you think?
But I think we had asked for a presentation to the board before those final comments, because I know one of the comments was that 17 corridor study was going to come as a final to the board, and I didn't feel comfortable with that without the whole board seeing it and just approving or just seeing a final draft. So
right, we don't meet in July. We've delayed the final adoption until the August meeting, and so we'll come back and I think Tyndall Oliver's staff is open to present or to sit down with meetings with any of the communities just to make sure that we tie up all the loose ends on that particular project. But it's been delayed, as the timing is, 2 months at this point.
Okay, great. Yeah.
So basically, what we present in June will be where we are right now with the best information of any comments we've received. And if we get additional input, we'll tidy that up between that point in time and August.
And thank you for making that. I just thought it was really important. Mm-hmm. So thank you. And while you were here, I just figured I'd ask.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace.
Okay.
Nick. You have something to say, Ron? I'm sorry.
No, I didn't know. You
okay, well, I was just paying attention over there. I'm going to blame this guy for it.
I would like to...
I don't want to get into a lengthy discussion on
the land for their comment, because when that meeting the other day caught a lot of us blindsided with information, and the idea of getting them back to the councils with a presentation is a very key item that we need mm-hmm. to get to working with. And so the moving of the date until August is very important, but we need to work with our city managers to get that presentation to the cities.
Have no problem with that. In fact, we just met with Matt and Laura to talk about improvements for DeBerry, and we're certainly willing to absolutely do that for Orange City and any other city that is along the corridor that we need to.
I think it's important, too, for the county council reps on mm-hmm. the west side to see that, too, because there's some interesting things in that study. Especially through DeLand Springs and Pearson area. So.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Nobody else. Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to stay on to the subject at hand. Next presentation discussion of update to the Transit Development Design Guidelines, the TDDGGB, and the draft report.
So. Yes.
I guess Mr. Wallace again or Lois?
It is Mr. Bob Wallace again, but I just want to point out that the transit design guidelines are closely linked to the TIA because, again, one of the biggest requests that we got from local governments as we were updating the TIA is to include and reference more transit. It's becoming more and more important to communities. And so we link these two projects together. And we're utilizing the same consulting firm so that they understand the issues very, very well. The design guidelines are also something that already was in place, again, developed almost a decade ago, but as times change, they need to be updated. And the intent of this document is to be available to people, developers, architects, right at the beginning of the development process. They may not be familiar with transit, but this becomes a handy-dandy tool. Then later in the development process, the TIA starts to require, under certain conditions, that the developer utilize and incorporate and include review by VOTRAN. So again, they're linked closely. With regards to the TIA, I just want to follow up and say it was very techy. It is very techy. I understand that. We've spent a lot of time talking with your staff to make sure that they are comfortable, understand, and it represents what they want and need. If any of you want more information about that, please let us know, and we're happy to sit down with you and your staff and make sure that you're comfortable with that document when we bring it back. So.
Okay. Okie dokie. So I think Lois has pretty much covered this slide in terms of what it says, and there's several things that have happened since it was last updated that are enumerated there as well. And really, the main emphasis of this slide was to let you all know that these design and development guidelines are, in fact, going to be integrated with the TIA, and that process has started and is ongoing. We should also mention that the design guidelines, as referenced here, are focused on the capital investment side of transit. Operations is a whole nother complex ball game, and again, the TIA and these design guidelines are focused on the capital. At some point in time, the community will need to address funding of operational costs as well. This again is citing some of the references that have occurred. Now, this is the table that really looks very complicated, but if we simplify it and say going across the top, we start with low density to hype development, and as we go across, we get greater density. You'll see transit-oriented development, neighborhood development, and mixed-use development. Those are the generalized categories of transit capital design amenities and guidelines. And coming across now, the bottom here, we have things that represent the capital investments. Bus pull-out bays, bulb outs, stop lighting, landscaping, and so forth. So this is a table that's designed to help both transit and VOTRAN, as well as the development community, generally understand the types of transit capital investments that might be considered and might be looked at as you go across the level of density increases across the top. So we would expect that this table, which is also an appendix in the TIA, be a pretty critical table, and when the development community has any questions on that, then they would go to VOTRAN, and VOTRAN would be more than willing and happy to explain in more detail how it might apply to their specific development project, which of course would be on a existing transit route. So I wanted to spend just a moment explaining that table. I'm sure it's 11 by 17 in the actual report, but that's an important table to provide guidance to the development community and also assist VOTRAN.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can I ask a question right now? You keep referring to VOTRAN, and I know we're talking about transit. Where does Flagler County Transport come into this?
Thank you for mentioning that, because Flagler County is tied into the TIA process. We've met with the county staff. We've also know where you are in terms of your fixed, your eventual going into the fixed route service and your current TD type service. So at the appropriate time when some of these amenities become justified and needed, we would expect that you also would utilize or at least reference this type of table. And we very definitely look forward to when that's going to occur. Sorry about that.
That's okay. We get planning funds here to the TPO for transit planning. And prior to the expansion of our planning boundaries, all of the transit dollars generally went to VOTRAN, and VOTRAN provided the 20% match for any planning studies through Volusia County. This particular project, again, because it was design guidelines that already existed, VOTRAN wanted to update them and paid the local match for this study. We have those planning funds available for Flagler, and we could easily take something like this through and make it specific for Flagler County, whether that's currently so that you can deal with paratransit issues or as we move closer towards implementation of fixed route service in that area.
Ms. Dennis?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
This is a suggestion, right? These are suggestions. These are not requirements. And that's correct.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I want to say, Megan. And this has to do with VOTRAN, which has to do with the county. So, and you're talking capital expenses. So, are there any funds going to be available for capital expenses? Or are we just talking, are we just spending money on planning and suggestions?
The TPO currently sets aside 30% of its SU set aside for capital for VOTRAN or for transit agencies. That is going to be split once designated recipient status, once you can access those funds. And then there are also funds available for the state.
this particular project is kind of unique in that it will go before County Council for approval as well as to this board. It goes to this board for approval in part because it's really important for everybody to understand, everybody at least in the Volusia County and Votran service area, to understand what sort of opportunities are offered and what sort of guidance is out there for everyone, and because we paid for it with MPO planning funds. But recognizing that the policy board that governs Votran is Volusia County Council, this will be presented to County Council as well for approval.
Again, as a suggestion.
It's a guide. It's okay. A guide that's available, again, so that early in the development process, we have circumstances like we have right outside our front door, which is if somebody takes the fixed route bus and gets off at the curbside, it is extremely difficult if you use a wheelchair to get to our front door. Right. That needs to be fixed when the site plan review process is underway, because coming back after the fact and trying to tell a property owner that they have to make changes, and they say, you want me to take on costs to make changes for something you already approved? We don't want to do that. So we're trying to avoid those infrastructure problems early on, especially for transit users who need to get from the fixed route system to the front door of, you name it, doctor's office.
No, I understand that. That's actually a really important issue for our citizens, and for whatever reason, for my constituents, well, and countywide, but for example, and where my mind is racing, if we're going to put a stop at the Walmart out on 44 versus a developer that's going to have a stop somewhere, you know, in another commercial development, there's different demands, but, and then you've also got that word in there that council loves to discuss about bus benches and bus shelters. But there's a huge demand for that. There's a huge demand for that, and a population I don't think that we're serving real well for
this. Yeah, and again,
this is
a guide that's intended for all of us to do a better job up front, reduce our costs so we don't have to go back in and correct poor decisions. It isn't an enforcement document. The TIA starts to ramp up enforcement. Not the TIA guidelines, but the actual TIA process that each of you approve that when you sit down and negotiate at the beginning of a project. And that's where the determination is made as to whether or not Votran staff needs to review this. And again, that gets into the actual negotiation. That's a local decision. The MPO as a whole doesn't get into that. We give the framework, and then we let you all go ahead and manage your approvals.
Thank you.
So,
what? Just a sidebar. And the money? There's no capital dollars that fund this.
Well, again, that's a part of the negotiating process, and we don't get into the mitigation costs. So, when you're approving a site plan, again, doing it well in advance should already have the appropriate curb cuts and sidewalks and access. And that should just be a part of the development itself or redevelopment.
Thank you.
Mr. Wallace?
Yes. And so this is just a tabular listing of the types of guidelines that could be considered and not specifically, again, required, but they're guidelines to consider as we go through the TIA process and address as required, if required, the transit component. So we thought we'd give a kind of a little overview of shelters, because shelters are a pretty repetitive type of improvement. So the basic concept here is we have a minimum number of boardings per day, and you can see it goes from 50 to greater than 200. And we have basic shelters and different versions of shelters and high capacity shelters. And we talk about where they might go. It's, again, a guideline to be used when a development application might come in. And you might look at how this particular location might impact the Votran route and then make a determination as to the type of shelter. And so this is also important because this helps to ensure, as we build shelters, compliance with ADA regulations. and at the same time improving pedestrian access and safety around the shelter and the loading area. You are correct. There is a capital cost associated with this. Capital money is a little easier to come by. And there's also some costs associated over time with having to maintain the pad as well. So, again, to play both sides of it, there's positives and negatives of this, and cost always becomes one of the issues.
Ms. Denny's, again.
You've got to know your county council members here going, capital dollars, go with that. And it's pretty easy. It's like, okay. Well, thanks for telling us. Here's the thing, though. With the current shelters and bus stops, those are all, as I understand it, the majority of them are handled by private companies that sell marketing, correct?
Mm-hmm.
They vary.
Yes.
But the majority of them are. The majority, at least in Volusia, those that I'm familiar with, are handled through private contractors and private industry, right?
That's correct. Heather Blank speaking for Volusia.
Yeah, it is. So
there are, just to help to clarify a little bit, that concerning shelters, that is the case. Most of them are handled by private entities that have agreements with the cities.
2020 Media, I think, handles
correct.
Most of Volusia County.
Yes. And then there, now in the bus bench situation, there are varying ways in which bus benches are actually handled in the community. Some of them are by these marketing arrangements with the bus bench provider, and some of them are strictly managed by the cities who undertake the actual procurement and placement of the benches and maintenance of those.
Well, the biggest issue we have with those now, the city and the county, are the ADA compliance. If there had to be a priority list with this, it's ADA compliance with access. But so I guess I'm listening to this presentation and the study and trying to do practical application for implementation and where that fits within the county and how we handle this, how we budget or we don't budget it, and we leave that to the private industry, which has handled it pretty well, and it would encourage that as long as we can and as much as we can for obvious reasons. But, okay, thank you.
Okay. I think Chair Davis and then Council Member Cusack.
I've noticed now going up and down 92 and 17 and all around the county like we do, I've noticed we got a bunch of new bus stops coming. Now, not every one of the bus stops we have that's come up look like these, even have benches on them, have really nothing. It's just, and we were told that we had to have them ADA compliant. If we did anything to the bus stop area, that's when we have to make it ADA compliant. Well, we've got a lot out there that are not ADA compliant, but they've been there for 40, 50 years. We are working on it. I talked with the Votran director, and he said that it cost about $27,000 to build one, just to pour the concrete slab down.
Just for the ADA.
Now, we've got four or five of them, new ones, and I was just coming up here this morning. Where was I coming up? Oh, it was yesterday. I was coming up 92. I wasn't going to try that this morning with I-4, the mess it was. I was coming up 92, coming to Daytona yesterday, and I noticed on the side of the road there's a bus stop there. There had to have been like 15 or 20 people standing at this bus stop waiting to get on this bus, but it's just one of those new ADA compliant ones. Who comes out and says the volume at this bus stop has reached the threshold? We need to put a bus bench. We need to put an awning. We need to do something here for the comfort of our citizens. That's where I put the question mark now.
There are ways in which that can occur, and that depends on when you say who actually decides. We do have a way in which we can analyze bus stop ridership at that level. We could tell you with good estimates the number of boardings and deboardings in any given time frame. We have all of that equipment on board our buses. Typically what happens is when it does reach that threshold, we already have a list of candidate locations. Those customers have already spoken to Votran and said, look, how can we get a bus bench here? So the question comes to us, and then we pose the question to whichever agency would be able to place that bus bench at that location.
Okay.
So that's the general process.
So I guess the basic, now we go back to the original statement, dollars and cents. We got a bus stop. It's reached capacity. We need to put this down. We've reached out. We've talked to everybody in the area. Do we talk to private industry? Do we come to this organization for the dollars? Or does it come out of our general budget? Because Votran stretched right to the wire. So where do we come up with the money to put the bus stop and update it?
These are the when I spoke to you previously about the arrangements that are in place, there are statutes that require that for a bus bench to be placed, the only way in which it can be placed is by the agreement of the authority over which the jurisdiction within which that bus stop resides. So, for example, we understand that the city of DeLand has an agreement for bus benches, and within the city of DeLand, those bus benches are placed in a particular way. In the unincorporated county, and I'll just quickly shift over to that situation, when we get a request for a bus bench, we have been in communication with the county about how we would make that happen. And my understanding right now is there's a procurement effort on the street today to find such a bus company to make that happen in the unincorporated area.
Okay. All right. That was dollars. That's good answer. Thank you.
You have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is pretty much answered. So you tell me if this is correct. There has to be some negotiation and decision-making from cities because many of these bus stops are in cities.
Correct.
And the county. So as we anticipate and have this discussion this morning, are the cities on board or have they heard this discussion? Because what is applicable to the county bus benches or stops should also be applicable to the cities. So where are we connecting the dots as it relates to the negotiation? Because the Votran is the pass-through. You don't really pay for your...
Let me explain that. Over the past many years, and I think I'm not mistaken in saying it's almost been 5 years, the county has been working with individual cities to try to establish some arrangements that are agreeable. And I believe there are those efforts that are underway at this point in time that both Stephen Scherer, the general manager for Votran, participates in with the county and the cities as we have been able to do so.
But the money comes from the county.
In the case of the benches that go into place, the money does not come from the county unless it's in the unincorporated county and unless there is no agreement to provide those benches agency.
It's a private industry, I understand that. But there was much discussion about, as we talked about, the increase in costs for ridership and how much Votran, the debt that we were incurring for buses. My concern is this, that we ought to have a budgeted item here as to how we're going to be able to fund the additional bus stops. And maybe you have that, but I'm just not aware of it. To me, we have to do some work as it relates to where we're heading, cities and counties together.
Agree.
If I could just get back to the design guidelines are a tool to help find those answers. It is not a requirement to go out and do. And back to, I think, the question that you're both answering, how you fund some of these improvements, as you mentioned, there are contracts with advertising companies. There are opportunities to fund improvements as a part of road construction projects, depending on who's improving the road. There are improvements that have to be under the responsibility of whatever the surrounding jurisdiction is, in this case, the city or the county. There are many different places where money can come from. That's not to make it sound like there's lots of money available to do this. I recognize that that is a challenge, but where it comes from depends on the application in a particular location. But these guidelines aren't intended to say, go out and do a bunch of work. These guidelines are saying, as work is done, use this as a reference to make better decisions so you don't have to go back and add things or fix things later.
Commissioner Gillum?
Thank you, Lois, because I think we kind of got off track there. It's the responsibility of the jurisdiction within which that bus stop resides to figure out how to pay for it. If it's a new construction, you can try and get the developer to do it. If it's not, I'll tell you what happened with Daytona. We got sued just like everybody else in this room for having bus stops that weren't ADA compliant. We pulled all the benches. They're sitting in a warehouse, and we simply don't have the money budgeted to replace them. So, you know, ultimately, if it's in unincorporated Volusia County, the county has to decide if it's priority and something we want to allocate money from towards. I can tell you we're doing strategic planning in Daytona Beach. Didn't even make the list. We aren't putting any money towards bus stops for our next fiscal year that'll begin October 1st. So if we do, we appreciate having these guidelines available to help us make sure they are reasonable and also ADA compliant. But ultimately, it's phenomenally expensive to do these things. And if you put a bench out, it's not just a bench. You have to, because you provided a place to sit for an abled person, you have to provide a place to sit for a disabled person, which means you got to pour the slab, and all of a sudden we're getting into the $27,000 per stop issue. So ultimately, I think you need to go back to your councils and determine whether or not this is a priority for your community or not. And I think a lot of you will find the same thing as what we have. You know, throwing $500,000 at bus stops is not as important as fighting crime, delivering, fire services, things like that. So, you know, we all have limited resources, but I do appreciate the fact that these guidelines are made available to Daytona and everyone else for, if funds do become available, or particularly with a new project. You know, Tanger Outlets, for example, you know, they could use something like this because there'll be a bus stop in the Tomoka Town Center.
Thank you. That about does it? Hold on.
Chairman, I pretty much don't need to repeat everything Robert said, but it's we use them as guidelines, and each municipality or county contracts with, whether it be 2020 Media, the one who spoke, or someone else, we have to set the guidelines on how they get a permit to erect it. So these guidelines are fantastic to help us manage how we allow them to build something in our city. So yeah. I don't see a controversy at all.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wallace. Lois, Executive Director reports. Ms.
Did you want to give Gene an opportunity to answer questions
sorry.
On DOT reports first?
Does he really want to?
It's his favorite part of the meeting.
Oh, yes. It's
he just sits here
my one big chance to talk to everyone. Just quickly, because I know it's been a busy agenda. The I-4 widening is progressing. We expect to have that complete later this calendar year. The I-95 widening system interchange, that one remains on track for spring of 18. Then the Reed Ellis Road, the 415 county line, the Reed Ellis Road, that one should be wrapping up any day now. And then, of course, the I-4 resurfacing, St. John's to Saxon Boulevard. That project should be completed, basically next spring. If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Now, Ms. Mullenbeck.
Thank you. I'll try to move through this very quickly. While we're thinking about our DOT liaisons, for those of you that have been around a while, you may be interested to know that Mary Schosel's last day with the department in the MPO office is May 31st. She's retiring. So I just want to let you know that if you have any relationship with Mary. Repurposing earmark funding, I've mentioned previously, there is approximately $3.2 million of old unused earmark money. There is no money unused in the Flagler County area. That 3.2 is all within the Volusia County area, and there are some strings attached to using that money. And in the interest of time, I will go ahead and send out a detailed memo to everybody outlining what some of those strings are. But the DOT has to send the recommendation. They're looking for a recommendation from the TPO, and they have to send that up to central office for review by August 15th. Well, that's just before our August meeting, which means we have to give them a recommendation next month at our June meeting. So we'll be placing this on the executive committee agenda. We'll discuss it and bring back some recommended options at the next meeting. With regards to the truck stops, we've already addressed that issue. The pedestrian safety and mobility report, just to let you know, that report is still in review by some of the reviewing agencies, and we expect to have that complete within the next couple of weeks and sent out to you all for your final review. But if you are one of the jurisdictions around the focus areas, you've probably already seen those reports. And if you have any questions, please let me know. The TPO survey, which will be wrapping up here in just a couple of days. So far, we have just over 1,000 surveys completed, and the board has a solid lead over the other committees, so thank you all for your efforts, or you can thank your staff for helping you have good response. The current year set aside, again, with the action taken earlier with the TIP amendment, we have allocated all of our current year funding. It's May. That's about time. And then the final item has to do with a TPO support for SunTrail applications. SunTrail is being funded $25 million a year. State dollars, 100% funding. The first tier of applications, or portion of that money, the first third, goes to the Coast to Coast, which is the number one project that the DOT and jurisdictions are working on. That effort from St. Petersburg all the way to Titusville that runs through Volusia County is quite substantially complete. Again, a couple of the last segments in our area were on the agenda earlier. The second tier is the St. John's River to Sea Loop, which runs down the east coast of Volusia County, really from St. John's, the St. Augustine area, to Volusia County, across the southern end of the county as a part of the Coast to Coast, and then back up the western side of the county, basically along 1792 Putnam. And then the third tier is going to be an open call for project applications for any projects on the SunTrail system from anywhere around the state. And the state DOT has developed a ranking criteria, much like we use in our prioritization process. And they've issued this call for projects. Now, all of the projects within Volusia County that are eligible for this funding are already included in the Coast to Coast and the St. John's River to Sea Loop. That being said, there are a lot of sub-segments that will be competing for that tier of money, and I think there are some local governments that are interested in competing for that third tier call for projects. The project application is June 20th. It is prior to our next board meeting. So my question is whether or not this TPO, we haven't had a request for support for an application. If there is a project that is currently on our priority list or on one of these trail segments that a local government would like us to support, is there a desire from this board to compete against the state for that third set of funding and provide a letter of support? No, again, knowing that we don't have specific project applications at this point, I can't give you any detail.
Mayor Kelly.
I would think it would be incumbent upon us to put that in there, which might then cause some of us to look at our particular projects and make application and move forward. You did say it's 100% funding if it's approved by the state, correct?
It is.
So I hated to be the one to ask this question, but why wouldn't we?
I think the state is already so envious of this area for doing so well that the likelihood of competing against the other state projects seems pretty slim, but if that's where you'd like to spend your time and submit, again, the question is whether or not this board wants to support any of those project applications, not knowing what they are currently. Would you like us to provide a letter of support, or again, we haven't received a request, but we know that the deadline for applications is before the next board meeting. So,
do we need a motion for that?
What are we supporting?
Yeah, well, that's the question is, if you don't have a project to support, what are you supporting? I mean, whenever we write a letter of support, we always say, in support of this project number, blah, 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 we hereby, you know, have a support it.
It would be any of the eligible projects or any of the projects that are eligible that are already on our priority list.
Well,
or
I guess
not.
Do we have a list?
I think we need to get a list of the projects that are eligible and get it out to the cities and to the county. And I mean, that's what you're looking for, is city and county support, correct?
In the past, as with Safe Routes to Schools applications, we didn't have the specific application, but we had, as a board, passed a resolution supporting any applications for projects that were identified in our feasibility studies.
Okay,
again, in that way, nobody was limited. You can make application without a letter of support from an MPO, but obviously a letter of support from your local MPO is going to give your application more standing. That being said, we are already in the top two-thirds of that funding.
Well, if we'd like to have a motion for a resolution of support for any of the projects.
I'll so move that, sir.
Second.
Is there any discussion on the motion for resolution of support on those projects? Is there any objection to the motion? Without objection, we'll have staff do that. Okay, that wrap it up?
That's all I have, thank you.
Okay. Any member comments here? Mr. Gillum?
I just want to point out that my daughter's home from college, and I told her the most exciting thing she could do this summer would be to come to this meeting, and she actually got out of bed, and she's sitting in the back.
Where
of the
is room. She? Oh, hey.
She did not fall asleep once. I've been watching.
We have good coffee in the back.
She needs to stand up and be recognized. Yes. There we go.
There you go.
There we go.
Is she going to review?
Yeah,
don't we have a pin or something we can give
no,
her?
No, we don't.
Oh, darn.
Give Dad a review?
We'll sign a copy of the Ms. Petusik.
On Monday for Memorial Day, the City of DeLand is having their annual Memorial Day service at 10 o'clock at Dreger's Park.
Okay. For those of you that on the west side or the east side, anything? We have a request. This is for the Executive Committee to change the time of the Executive Committee meeting next week from 8:30 to 8 o'clock. Is there any problem with that?
Not for me.
I'm all in favor of that because I'm not a member.
Yeah, I'm in favor of that.
7, 6:30.
All right, okay. 8 o'clock it is.
Just for next week.
Just this one meeting. It's.
I'll leave my house at 7 a.m.
Maybe someday we will, you know, Robert's Rules of Order does allow for electronic meetings. Maybe someday we'll get set up that way where you can sit there in your bathrobe with your slippers on.
That's
and
too much information.
Anyway, any other comments? All right. Next River to Sea TPO meeting will be June 22nd, and it will be a busy meeting. We like today, will be a lot of issues that we need to take care of. And there's not a July meeting, so the meeting after that will be in August. So you're going to get June and July, and then August, you're going to get dumped on again. But it won't be my game at that point. And with that, is there any objection? Without objection, we are adjourned. We are adjourned.
Sir?